Concordia Theological Seminary's 26th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions presents Professor Lawrence R. Rast. His paper, Fellowship Issues in the 19th Century, Implications for the Future of the LCMS.
At the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, there was a great controversy over who would play first and who would play last. The Who were able to garner for themselves the opportunity to play first. As was traditional in their act at that point, they smashed the drums and the guitars at the end of their show. And Jimi Hendrix, having been relegated to the last point, had to find some way to overcome the debacle that he had just witnessed. And so he lit his guitar on fire before he smashed it. That serves as a fitting introduction for this paper. In 1866, the year I joined the seminary faculty, Dr. Samuel Sprecher, speaking from the chair at the convention of the General Synod, which was meeting here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, stated that the Pennsylvania Synod has severed their practical relations with the General Synod and therefore had withdrawn from the, quote, partnership of the synods, end quote. Pennsylvania, founded in 1748, was the oldest and the largest of the American Lutheran synods at that point. And its removal ultimately had devastating effects on the General Synod's membership. Yet, the General Synod was willing, at this point in time, to risk the exodus of a significant portion of its membership. That drives us to a very important question. Why? Why would they risk that? Next slide, John. We're having to do this the old-fashioned way. How did they get to this point? Well, what you'll see from the graph that's there on the screen at this point is the tremendous growth that Lutheranism in America experienced in the wake of the 1840s. Tremendous immigration, and with that, Germans, Scandinavians, swelling into the ranks of Lutheran church membership in America. Many of those who came, Germans and Swedes and Finns and so forth, were of a decidedly confessional bent. And beginning about 1840, American Lutheranism began to change in its character. Whereas in 1840, the majority of American Lutherans were just that, American, and largely indistinguishable from their American Christian counterparts, within a few short years, Lutheranism in America was noticeably confessional. What happened? Well, obviously, the immigration had an enormous impact. But in addition to that, there were some other elements at work. In the mid-1850s, the great Reformed church historian, Philip Schaff, identified three kinds of Lutherans in America. Where in 1840 you would have had largely a flat picture with one category, by 1855, there were now three. The first group he called the New Lutherans, and these were the Lutherans largely settled around and within the General Synod and largely committed to its institution at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. This group had at best a quatenus subscription to the Augsburg Confession. And I say at best because the actual formula of subscription to the Augsburg Confession among this bunch went something like this. We accept the Augsburg Confession insofar as it teaches the fundamental doctrines of Scripture in a manner substantially correct in the doctrinal articles. The fundamental doctrines of Scripture in a manner substantially correct in the doctrinal articles. Now, obviously, that leaves you a lot of room to work, and work it they did. They were, after all, a general synod. One thing they found difficult to handle, though, was a distinct Lutheran confession. And as these confessional Germans and Scandinavians began to pour into America in the mid-1830s and beyond, the General Synod increasingly found itself pressed by a new commitment, groups with new commitments, decidedly confessional in their positions. And here we're talking about those who were derisively labeled the old Lutherans. The new Lutherans often called themselves, very purposefully, American Lutherans, and the adjective became more important than the noun. With the old Lutherans, however, they said, you can call us whatever you want, but what we are in fact is, whatever you want, but what we in fact are confessional Lutherans. And they had a decidedly quia subscription to the Lutheran confessions. Foremost amongst these over time would come to be the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, formed in 1847. However, it was not the first Lutheran church in America to subscribe quia to the Book of Concord in its entirety. That happened when the Buffalo Synod was formed in 1845, June 25th to be exact, no coincidence. So we had two groups, at least, according to Schaff, and he really didn't like either one. He thought that the new Lutherans had given up their identity, had sold their birthright for a pot of mash, and they really were not effective at all in representing what true Lutheranism was about. Their quotidian subscription, he believed, compromised their confession in the world and forced them to be essentially meaningless in terms of their witness. The old Lutherans, on the other hand, were not much better. While they did have a fine confession, they went too far. The problem, in Schaff's mind, was the formula of Concord. Seeing the formula of Concord as a proper exposition of the Augsburg Confession and drawing out the points made therein led Schaff to conclude that this group was formed and made up of extremists, those who were unwilling to grant any other Christian true membership in Christ's church. They saw themselves as the one true church, perhaps the true visible church of God on earth, and none other. And so he had just as strong words against this crew as he did against the new Lutherans. So what was left? A third group, what he called the mediating Lutherans. Schaff was a Hegelian, and now you can see it at work here. Somewhere between the antithesis of new Lutheranism and the thesis of new Lutheranism and the antithesis of old Lutheranism came forth what he believed was the proper synthesis of mediating Lutheranism. Characterized initially by the Pennsylvania Synod and then later on by the General Council, this group was the genius of Lutheranism lived in the American context. It was a group that embraced its confessional documents, in fact, moved towards a quia subscription over the course of its life. Yet, it used those doctrines within the specific context of the American setting. So, quia in context, argued Schaff, was what Pennsylvania was all about. And what, therefore, the Pennsylvania Synod could do would be to help bring Lutheranism along, help it develop, help it progress to that which would allow it to achieve its true genius here in the world. He looked with great favor upon those who were part of the Pennsylvania Synod and hoped for the best for their activities here in the United States. Three groups of Lutherans by 1855. How would this play out, and what would occur as these groups interacted? The stories surrounding that, I think, still have meaning for us today, and allow me to unpack some of them. But first, a commercial from our sponsor. John, you're going to have to skip the next slide, if you would, the 14th slide. Within this group of mediating Lutherans, there were a whole series of important leaders and men who had a tremendous impact on shaping and forming the Lutheran Church in the late 19th century. The first amongst them was the great missiologist, William Alfred Passavant. Passavant, born in 1821, died in 1894. He was a member, originally, of the General Synod. He had studied at the Gettysburg Seminary under Schmucker, went out into the church in the 1840s, and did what most early pastors in their early ministries did at that point in time. He practiced revivals. However, quickly he became uncomfortable with these activities and began to step back and reconsider the kind of witness that he was offering. One of the things that he was concerned about, however, as he began to draw ever more clearly his doctrinal conclusions, was to continue to wed that vigorous advocacy of the truth that was emerging in his own life with also an equally vigorous mission. He also linked that with a great deal of philanthropic work, the effects of which continue to be felt and to be present in Lutheranism in the 21st century. He was the great missiologist among the leaders of the English-speaking Lutherans who were beginning to become confessional. A second figure was a fascinating character, if you would, John. This is the only picture I have of him, unfortunately. This wasn't what he looked like at his maturity. Beel Melanchthon Schmucker was, in fact, the son of Samuel Simon Schmucker, the son of Sam, you might say. But he departed in important ways from his father's position, where his father was a vigorous advocate of revivals and a tempered confessional subscription. Beel Schmucker turned out to be one of the great, perhaps the greatest, Lutheran liturgiologists working in the English language in the late 19th century. To him, perhaps more than anyone else, we have thanks to give for the production of the Lutheran Common Service, published in 1888, the basis of our own page 15 in the Lutheran hymnal. Beel Schmucker moved away from his father's convictions, even though he'd been taught from his earliest youth of the tempered nature of confessional subscription and the necessity of changing liturgical practice as advocated by his father. He became his own man and has left wonderful, wonderful productions and relics for us to continue to enjoy even here in the present. But if Passavant was the missiologist and Schmucker was the liturgiologist, two other figures have far greater importance in the entire discussion into which we are to proceed. The first was Joseph Augustus Cise, 1823 to 1904. One good thing about these guys is that, you know, no matter what your haircut's like or what beer you happen to wear at any given point in your life, you can't look worse than them. Now, Joseph Cise was an enormously important figure in late 19th century Lutheranism, perhaps best described as the great homiletician of the four men that I'm showing you here at this point, who led English-speaking Lutheranism into an appreciation for the historic one-year lectionary and to encourage Lutheran pastors to preach according to a lectionary. That was largely absent in the early part of the 19th century, and most Lutherans in America simply preached occasionally in terms of their choice of text. They just picked whatever worked or whatever fit. How did somebody put it yesterday, a point in search of a text? That may have very well summarized much of the preaching. Cise, however, was vigorous in his advocacy for the use of the lectionary as well as his advocacy for Lutheran liturgical matters. And to wed the two together, he believed it was within the context of the Lutheran divine service that God worked, creating, gathering, sanctifying, enlightening, and nurturing, and maintaining his church. However, over time, some other interesting elements began to creep into his theology as well. I spoke about several of them a few years back. Namely, he was an early dispensational premillennialist. Figure out how that one works with your Lutheran confession. Nevertheless, because of his work in producing sermons that covered not only biblical books, many expository sermons, but in addition to that, the one-year lectionary ceases influence on Missouri when it began to shift from German to English has not been yet fully estimated, and I think it would be a good endeavor for someone to do that, not me. On the other hand, his particular views regarding church fellowship will go in a different direction and will actually provide, I believe, some of the distinctive points that Lutherans will pursue in the 20th century. Finally, the last of the four, Charles Porterfield Croth, 1823 to 1883. Croth was the son of a Gettysburg college professor, later a Gettysburg seminary professor. He knew Schmucker, Samuel Schmucker, from his earliest youth. He studied at Gettysburg, as did all of these four, and yet, over time, began to change his mind on the confessional position that he had received as a student. As he entered into his ministry in the early 1840s, one of his first important endeavors as a scholar was to investigate the Lutheran doctrine of the real presence. He was given this task so that he could debunk that false teaching. However, as he began to delve into the matter, he quickly found that there was a consistency of thought and teaching among Lutherans, historically speaking, that had been, in fact, compromised within the last few decades, at least from an American perspective. That is to say, while many American Lutherans were rejecting the doctrine of the real presence, what Croft found as an absolute unified point throughout historic Lutheranism was an advocacy for the doctrine of the real presence. This threw him into a terrible, terrible position and forced him to then grapple with a basic point. How do we define what is Lutheran? What does it mean to be a Lutheran? What is the source of our identity? To a greater or lesser extent, all of these four gentlemen were grappling by the late 1840s with the same question. What is the extent? What is the source? What is definitional in terms of Lutheran identity? Is Lutheranism simply a spirit, an idea of progress and growth and development, as Samuel Schmucker had argued? Or do you define Lutheranism on the basis of its confessional documents? Over the course of the late 1840s and through the 1850s, these four men finally came to the conclusion on the latter point, with Croth providing the leadership. Lutheranism is defined by its confessional documents. The Augsburg Confession as the basis, the basic document, understood according to the intentions of its authors, and then rightly exposited in the Formula of Concord. That was a significant break, particularly considering the background of these four men. As I've already alluded to, and we'll move through this fast, last year Clement Preuss said, you can't have a RAS speech without talking about Samuel Schmucker. So I am. I'm going to do that now, if you wouldn't mind. Schmucker's legacy was the formation of the Gettysburg Seminary, and then later on his infamous definite synodical platform. I won't belabor the point, you know it. But what Schmucker proposed was really to correct the Augsburg Confession in 5 points in this document of 1855. 4 points that needed to be rejected, and 1 point that needed to be added. The point that needed to be added, according to Schmucker, was the divine requirement of the Christian Sabbath. The divine requirement of one 24-hour day in a 7-day period, the week, that had to be given to God in order to experience the blessing of God. The four rejected points were the doctrine of the real presence, the doctrine of baptismal regeneration, any kind of use of private confession and absolution, and then finally, what he called a rejection of the ceremonies of the Mass. He was a revivalist, after all. With the publication of the definite synodical platform, the lines were drawn hard and fast within American Lutheranism. Were you a platformite or not? Interestingly enough, the majority of Lutherans rejected his work. And though most of English-speaking pastors in America had in one way or another been trained by Schmucker, by 1850 many were rejecting his position, 1855. And so it's by this time that you end up with Schaff's three categories, with the new Lutherans on the one side, Schmucker and his followers, the old Lutherans, the Missourians, that is the immigrants, on the other side, and then this group, characterized by Passavant, Beal Schmucker, Joseph Cies, and Croth, somewhere in the middle. But Schaff didn't quite get it right. Didn't quite. Because one thing he didn't understand about this group was that within the mediating group, within the center group, there was also a division of opinion. There were at least two groups within that. One group that leaned toward the General Synod, and one group that was increasingly leading toward the old Lutheran position. Things were headed for a showdown. After the definite platform emerged, arrived, appeared, I guess would be the best word, and then collapsed, there were a series of responses. The first was a series of free conferences that were held in the late 1850s, up through they intended to keep going, but they didn't get beyond Article 4 of the Augsburg Confession. They were taking an article a year in these free conferences, but the War of Northern Aggression broke it off. My good colleague just shakes his head when I do that. I was a pastor in Tennessee, after all, I have to say that. There goes my political career, he says, as if I ever had one. Now, the free conferences helped Lutherans of various synods get to know one another better. And in fact, the basis for this was simply if one accepted the Augsburg Confession, then one could participate freely without engaging one's synodical commitments. This provided the opening forum for confessional Lutherans, both of immigrant background as well as the English background, to get to know one another. And it had very positive results within the Lutheran community, especially the English-speaking community. Increasingly, it was the case that the Pennsylvania Synod and those who were inclined towards its position were more and more unhappy and expressing that unhappiness with the limited confessional subscription of the General Synod. And these free conferences helped these English-speaking Lutherans articulate those concerns. To make a jump and to move us along, one of the things that would come out of this was great tension within the Pennsylvania Synod itself, leading, in fact, to this break ultimately within the General Synod that we opened with. If you would, John, actually, you're probably going to have to do one more. In 1864, the General Synod met at York, Pennsylvania. And while the meeting went on, there was an interesting thing that happened. In fact, the General Synod compromised its own constitution, and this led to a series of events that had an enormous impact on American Lutheranism. The catalyst for the break was simply this. A group called the Franckian Synod, named after August Hermann Francke, applied for admission into the General Synod, even though it had never recognized the Lutheran confessional documents in any way, not even with the limited confessional subscription of the General Synod. And so, as a result, on Tuesday, May 10th, 1864, President C.W. Schaefer of the Pennsylvania delegation entered this protest. It read in part, "We are happy to disclaim in any the least disposition to impugn the motives of the brethren who were pleased to favor the application of the Franckian Synod. But we are at the same time free to express deep grief, the deep grief we feel in the conviction that by this action, the General Synod has sadly and lamentably violated its constitution." Schaefer believed the violations included the Franckian Synod's failure formally to adopt the Augsburg Confession, even with the General Synod's limited subscription. Indeed, wrote Schaefer, "the whole history of the Franckian Synod presents it as having no relation nor connection whatever with the Augsburg Confession. Therefore," he concluded, "it cannot," excuse me, "it cannot be a regularly constituted Lutheran Synod." But the General Synod admitted it into its fellowship anyway. And as a result, Pennsylvania withdrew. A key point. In withdrawing from the General Synod, the Pennsylvania Ministerium simply appealed to the terms of its re-engagement with the General Synod in 1853. Namely, that if at any point the General Synod compromised its constitution, the Pennsylvania Synod must withdraw to report to its own church, its own synodical body. However, this was interpreted in two ways. The Pennsylvanians saw it as simply a matter of stepping back and trying to work things out to determine where things were going in the General Synod before it would make any further actions. The General Synod, however, interpreted it as Pennsylvania just quit. Well, Pennsylvania didn't help by some of the other things that it did in that year, 1864. It also formed its own seminary in the wake of the break at York and called Charles Porterfield Crawl to be the first professor. It, by in so doing, basically said, we have no longer any confidence in the General Synod's seminary at Gettysburg. This was interpreted again as evidence that Pennsylvania had quit. However, others were saying that that in order to bring things to a happy conclusion and a happy reunion, that when the General Synod next met, perhaps Pennsylvania should be recognized and should be allowed to participate. Others, however, said in no way can it be a requisite part of our synodical fellowship. And so, when the General Synod met in 1866 at Fort Wayne, Samuel Sprecher denied admittance to the Pennsylvania Ministerium, saying, we no longer have any official knowledge of this synod since it has withdrawn from us. The reasons for his action were driven by the growing confessionalism of the Pennsylvania Synod. So there's Pennsylvania. Suddenly it is sitting all by itself as a Lutheran synod. Where would it go? It immediately issued an appeal to all confessional Lutherans in America, to the Ohio Synod, to the Missouri Synod, and so forth, to come to a meeting at Reading, Pennsylvania in December 1866 with an eye towards the unification of all Lutherans in America, all confessional Lutherans in America. Most confessional synods sent observers at the very least, and many participated. And out of this emerged in May 1867 a new Lutheran church body, the General Council, formed here in Fort Wayne once again. The General Council accepted all the symbolical books of the Lutheran Confession and did so in a quia fashion. So on paper, their subscription was good. Yet some of the more conservative synods were not willing to enter into the fellowship, including the Missouri Synod. And the reason for that was a simple one. That is, while the General Council had a wonderful doctrinal statement of confessional position on paper, in its practice, it was thoroughly heterodox. That was Missouri's position. And until there was complete agreement in doctrine and practice, there could be no formal church union. And so Missouri stayed out. Others who initially participated removed themselves, the most important of the group being the Ohio Synod. I've been lagging, sorry, John. It hit two more, and then we'll get into the, yeah. One more, there you go. And in 1868, at the General Council's meeting, convention held in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the issues came to the fore. The so-called 4 points came to the forefront. The 4 points were chiliasm, lodge membership, pulpit fellowship, and altar fellowship. The way the Ohio Synod formed its question was simply this, quoting, the delegates of the Evangelical Lutheran Joint Synod of Ohio would therefore, believing un-Lutheran doctrine and practices to exist in some synods, respectfully request the Venerable General Council of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in North America to favor us with information on the following points. What relation will this venerable body have in the future to chiliasm, mixed communion, the exchanging of pulpits with sectarians, secret or unchurchly societies? The General Synod responded very quickly, but not in a fashion to satisfy the more confessional synods. For the sake of time, let me just mention one response. Communion with those not of our church. The General Council said that the principle of a discriminating as over against an indiscriminate communion is to be firmly maintained. Heretics and fundamental errorists are to be excluded from the Lord's table. The responsibility of an unworthy approach to the Lord's table does not rest alone on him who makes the approach, but also upon him who invites it. Here was the key distinction in the General Council's practice between an indiscriminate communion which characterized the General Synod. They had a y'all come appeal every time they held the Lord's Supper. Every Christian is welcome to participate. As opposed to the new General Council position, namely a discriminating communion position. That is, they would exclude heretics and fundamental errorists, yet welcome Christians from other denominations who affirmed the fundamental doctrines of Scripture and who lived and lived a manifestly Christian life. It became the responsibility of individual pastors in individual situations to make the determination about the worthiness and preparedness of those who approached the table. Missouri said, Ohio said, the Iowa Synod remained in, but did so at arm's length at this point in time. And the result was they weren't actually formal members of the General Council. They always had this funny relationship. Well, for a long time, they had a funny relationship where they were given right of debate and appearance on the floor of their conventions, but not a vote. So what emerges is a great controversy within the General Council that will bring forth a couple of the most important points within the English-speaking Lutheran Church in the late 19th century, namely the famous Akron Rule. You've learned it probably as the Galesburg Rule. The Akron Rule read, the rule is Lutheran pulpits are for Lutheran ministers only. Lutheran altars are for Lutheran communicants only. The exceptions to the rule belong to the sphere of privilege, not of right. The determination of the exceptions is to be made in consonance with these principles by the conscientious judgment of pastors as the cases arise. The Akron Rule established the General Council's discriminate communion policy. It did not provide an exclusivist basis. That was expressly rejected. Akron was held in 1872. By 3 years later, when Galesburg, the meeting of the General Council at Galesburg was held, things were prepared for a blow-up. Some suggested that the reason the General Council held this meeting far in the West was so that it would be in the midst of the immigrant population, some of whom were members of the General Council, and that the more liberal pastors of the East wouldn't make the trip. If that's true, who knows? But the result was, in fact, just that. What came out of Galesburg was the so-called Galesburg Declaration. And that is, oops, you didn't do the other two exceptions. Sorry, John. What came out of Galesburg was the so-called Galesburg Declaration, which said this about the Akron Rule. The sole change in this action is it declares whence we got the rule, to wit, out of the Word of God and the confessions of our church. It only makes explicit what was implied before. And in the practical application of it, all pretense that the rule is only a human rule or rule of order is precluded. So you have two things at work by this time. A rule based on Scripture that has built into it exceptions, discriminate communion policy. The reason for this was the general character of the General Council. It was a church body that had come out of the older General Synod where an indiscriminate communion practice had prevailed, where revivals had largely characterized its worship practice, where there was a general laxity in confessional subscription. Now, what this church body was trying to do, and the way Charles Porterfield Croft and Joseph Sees together tried to interpret the rule and its explanation in the Galesburg Declaration, was to see it as a catechetical theme to improve not only the doctrinal position of the church, but its practice. It didn't work. The basic problem was that you had within the rule, with its exceptions, opportunity for the two sides that already existed within this church body to emphasize that which they desired. Either the one group, Charles Porterfield Croft's group, to emphasize the rule, or the other group, led by Joseph Sees, to emphasize the exceptions. The long friendship, reaching back into the 1840s, of Charles Porterfield Croft and Joseph Augustus Sees was destroyed in the midst of the controversy that followed. And in many ways, Krauth's early death in 1883 was attributable to the stress that he experienced in the midst of this controversy. The stress and the destruction of a friendship that emerged over this is characterized by some of the interchanges between the two, Cease and Krauth. For example, on November 25th, 1875, Cease wrote to Krauth. Cease didn't go to Galesburg, by the way. He was very upset about what had happened. "You who are not pastors," he said, "nor in direct contact with the people," that is, you Ivory Tower seminary professors, "may not feel it, but the trouble is rising. Our paper must speak," he edited the Lutheran and Missionary. "I must give answer to the pressure which is more strongly alienating some of our best ministers and men from the General Council. Unless some speedy and satisfactory explanation is given, then we will have a tragedy on our hand." Krauth didn't respond. Cease wrote again, "It is simply impossible to maintain ourselves on the Missouri ground," implicitly the ground you now occupy, Charles. "It will split the Pittsburgh Synod. It will take the Indiana, Ohio, and Holston Synods out of the council at once. Right or wrong, the facts are stronger than the logic. The education of 100 years cannot be legislated out by the crude utterance of a moment." In other words, Cease saw this as a matter of policy, not so much a matter of confession. And ultimately, he would say, his congregation, St. John Congregation in Philadelphia, that that they would practice as they saw fit, whatever the synod might say. "It is our unanimous conviction," they said, "and belief, that we violate no given law of God and do not compromise any doctrine of the divine word held and confessed by the common Lutheran Church when under reasonable circumstances and just limitations we invite into our pulpit or receive at our altar ministers or people whom we have cause to regard as sincere believers of the saving doctrines of the gospel and devout observers of its sacred ordinances, even though they may not be of our own immediate conviction." Cease won. Krauth died in 1883. Cease died in 1904. And his vision for Lutheranism with a discriminate communion practice prevailed. And it became, as I had that little schematic up before you saw, within the General Council, more or less the accepted practice, and then continued to inform the United Lutheran Church in America when it was formed in 1918, and then the Lutheran Church in America when it was formed in 1962, and even to the present, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America formed in 1988. There's a certain consistency, I think, you can find within the practice of those church bodies. But what about us? I would advance the following, that if you think about Philip Schaff's three kinds of Lutherans, if you revisit his typology, something interesting begins to emerge. He saw the General Synod on the one side as new Lutherans, the Missouri Synod and others as the old Lutherans, and then this large group of mediating Lutherans within the middle, the best Lutherans. I've argued that there were at least four, maybe he missed a category or two, that is, you had the new and the old, and then within the mediating groups, those who were leaning to one side or the other. But what Schaff did that I think is helpful is that he identified the church bodies that characterized these positions. You knew where the General Synod stood. You knew where the Missouri Synod stood. The General Council was a little bit more, it was finding its way. I would advance that within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod today, you find those three groups or four groups within. That is where you see the external divisions within Schaff's typology. Those external divisions now we have internalized. The new Lutherans who say plunge into American culture with abandon and who have largely lost their Lutheran identity, certainly we've all experienced that and seen that. The old Lutherans, I'm looking around at a few, those recalcitrant extremists who base everything on the formula of Concord. Any here? Raise your hand. I'm noticing those who didn't. That's interesting. Now and then within the great Missouri middle, those who tend towards one or the other. Now, there are certainly limitations to this typology, but what I think it begins to show is the dynamic character of the situation in which we live. And I think I would advance, and perhaps you would agree, you're welcome to challenge me on this as well, that amongst those who are of the new Lutheran perspective, to use that kind of language, and of the old Lutheran perspective, that we have distinct minorities in each, but that Missouri is largely made up of the middle. That is, Missouri largely is analogous to the General Council of the late 19th century. So what do we do? Well, think about it. If the founders of Missouri were to visit us today, I'm quite confident that they would be distressed by the present circumstances of our church body. The fact is, as we all know, we can cite innumerable instances of erroneous practice which occur week in and week out in our synod. In some cases, open communion is becoming the norm. In other cases, a discriminate position like that of the General Council obtains. Worship practices out of the agenda and hymnals that are not synodically approved is increasingly popular. We've all seen that as well. Practices like these were at the root of Missouri's rejection of fellowship with the General Council in around the year 1870. The concern over the Four Points divided Missouri from those others. But at the same time, the General Council continued to say, we're trying to catechize our church into a more firm and appropriate position. The question for the General Council was, what is that position? Within the groups, there were those who argued for a more consistent practice in line with what they had learned and been taught from the Lutheran confessions. There were those at the same time who said, we're simply not willing to make that move. When Missouri refused to join the General Council, how did the council respond? Some ignored Missouri and quickly began their trek back to reunion with the General Synod. They merged into the ULCA, as I said. Others, like Charles Porterfield Krauth, argued that it would take a generation at least for catechesis to turn that church body around. Walther, by the way, agreed with him, but said, until that was the case, there would be no fellowship. In the end, the General Council failed because of the weight of its false practice, not because it lacked a good confessional subscription. Where they had catechized much of the clergy, and this is a key point, I believe, where the General Council had catechized much of its clergy, those pastors did not successfully catechize their people, and they did not come along. The result has been nothing short of disaster, I believe, for confessional Lutheranism in America. The reality for us is that we now find ourselves in a position much like that of the General Council. Many are running towards a General Synod like the General Synod of the early 21st century, namely the ELCA, and seeking stronger ties with them. Others, many others, happily, are engaged in the marathon of catechizing a church that has lost some of its identity both in doctrine and practice. In the end, the General Council failed not because of the lack of political effort on the part of its confessional leaders. They were geniuses at that, as a matter of fact. But it failed because its pastors gave up in the marathon effort to catechize their congregations in orthodoxy and orthopraxis. This little bit is why I still have great hope for our church. We continue to produce solid pastors who are catechizing the church little by little. We have brave and courageous lay people who make the good, solid confession. However, or better yet, that is to say, you guys who are out there in the trenches, day in and day out preaching, celebrating, teaching, visiting, and carrying out the Holy Office faithfully, you are the ones who are doing the work that will turn this ship around. You lay people who within the context of your lives, day in and day out, make that good confession and live within the context of your vocation. You are the ones who will turn this church body around. Honestly, most of us here at this point have lived in what is, in terms of practice at least, a heterodox church. I turned 40 this year, so now I'm looking at my mortality. It's right in my face. It's taken us at least 70 years to get into this a series of synodical resolutions that will immediately correct things. We can't make appeals to philosophy, Enlightenment thinking, or post-Enlightenment thinking, or postmodernist thinking. Those won't give us the way out. We live in what is an ahistorical, some cases anti-creedal society that lacks any sense of Catholicity whatsoever. And we have, from our inception as the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. American culture always challenges and pressures confessional Lutheranism. However, we've been given the good confession. Our forefathers made it. They did so faithfully, and they have delivered that to us so that we can be here gathered this year in 2003 and do so as well, as we'll do in a few minutes as we move to chapel. So is there a future for the LCMS? I pray so. I hope so. But there are no guarantees. History has its ways of throwing interesting things into the mix. Yet history also shows us the tremendous way God has blessed confessional Lutheranism throughout its history. If you looked at Lutheranism in 1840, all seemed lost. Why not just give up? By 1855, confessional Lutherans were on the rise. Certainly some of those failed in their endeavors. The General Council did not achieve what Croft dreamed it would. The LCMS could too. I'm not naive. Things could easily go from bad to worse. It happened in church history before, it could again. However, I believe that we have a wonderful opportunity at this point to make the faithful confession, to continue to make that faithful confession, to work day in and day out to make that faithful confession, not only as pastors, but to teach that to our people, to give them the good confession for themselves so they can make it within their church, within the context of their vocation. I believe we have a tremendous opportunity, but if we were to renege on that now and give ourselves off or take ourselves away from that opportunity, then the end is certainly already determined. The General Council found itself pressed on every side. A confessing church will always find that to be the case. However, what God has enabled you to do by calling you to Himself, Holy Baptism, what He has enabled you to do by continuing to nurture you in the faith through the preached word and administered sacraments, is to make that good confession and to continue making it. As a pastor, you are the key. As a lay person, you are the key. It's no small thing for 700 people to be gathered here at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in late January 2003. The future of our church is at stake. Yet, the Lord's promise remains firm. I will neither leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you always. And in His promise, He enables us to continue to make that good confession.